you owe me. Pay me my money down. Pay me or go to jail. Pay me my money down.
Hello and welcome, ladies and gents, to Middle Market Musings, a podcast dedicated to the people and ideas of the middle market. We're delighted that you've chosen to join us today. My name is Charlie Gifford of New Heritage Capital.
And I'm Andy Greenberg of Greenberg Variations Capital. Today we're speaking with Christina Pye, partner at Fort Point Capital. Before we begin, we'd like to thank our sponsors, New Heritage Capital and Greenberg Variations Capital. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Christina Pye, partner at Fort Point Capital, welcome to Middle Market Musings.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Are you excited?
Definitely. A little nervous, but excited.
You said, Christina, you said you were nervous. What were you nervous about?
We're very intimidating people.
It seems like a free-flowing conversation. Who knew where it was going to go? And I mean, I don't know what to expect.
Well, buckle up. It's going to be, if past is any precedent, it's going to be really, really, really exciting. But anyway, we're excited to have you here. We usually start this out by saying, where are you from? What'd you do? But we're gonna turn that on its head a little bit here. First of all, I'm going to start by saying I'm delighted to have a Bostonian on this program. For reasons unknown to me, it seems as though we are overweight Philadelphia guests. So thank you for joining us.
And that can't be true.
It is true. I think was in the middle of saying something. Can you?
Yes, I know. You're in the middle of saying something fake.
No.
All right. We'll come back to it.
But I also learned, because my counterpart here connected us up and invited you on. But I also understand that we share a deep, deep love of Boston sports teams. If I could wave a magic wand, if I could grant you a wish, any team that you love could win their respective championship in the next 12 months, who would it be?
Definitely the Celtics.
Oh, good.
Well, first of all, I think probably they're the only one who could.
Yeah.
At this point, but I just love the team. I mean, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, they're homegrown. We've seen them sort of mature, and the team just looks like they're having fun playing together. They brought in Porzingis and Holiday, and Derek White's probably my favorite of all of them. Horford's been sacrificing for the team. They've come so close, and I think it would be really wonderful if they just pushed it across the finish line.
Not to get too deep on Boston Celtics basketball, but I said to somebody the other day, the most improved part of the team is actually Derek White's haircut, because he got rid of that horrible afro and that big white headband he wore. Now he's just bald. He looks a lot better and he's playing great.
Yeah. Well, I do think that his hair made him seem taller, which I think was probably helpful for him in certain circumstances, but I agree. I mean, he has a really good smile and a really good face. So I think that this highlights it better.
There you go. Well, all right. Well, we'll pick that back up, because I know Andy wants to go deep on Boston sports, but let's start.
You succeeded in finding a niche topic within what is already a niche offering.
Well, I'll ask you, Charlie, whose fashion sense on the Celtics do you enjoy the most, A, and then B, who's your favorite player?
Who's my favorite fashion sense? Well, last night, Kristaps Porzingis was wearing a rust-colored suit.
It was amazing.
It was pretty cool. And I have to – but, you know, favorite player, I think they're all – I mean, who's my – I love Porzingis. I think his footwork is unrivaled, maybe this side of Luka Doncic and Nikola Jokic. But I love Drew Holiday, too, because I think they're all accepting their roles and not bitching – about it. And these guys could be scoring a lot more per game, but they're all just picking their spots. And Horford had 20 plus points last night after averaging, you know, whatever, 4, 5, 6, 7 a game. It's pretty fun to see.
I feel like when they're passing the ball and just making that extra pass, as opposed to just doing their like little ISO game, it's like almost beautiful to watch.
I agree. All right. Well, it's been lovely having you join us here today, Christina. I hope you found the time to be worthwhile, and thanks very much. Oh, no, we have other things to talk about as well. Let me start by saying that I understand we also share a common upbringing, having both been raised on the hard scrabble streets of the North Shore of Boston, right? Pride of Hamilton, Massachusetts?
Mean streets, for sure. There were definitely a lot of trees, a few horses. Uh-huh. So, yeah, it's, I think it's where I really sort of got my grit. Was, that's, you know,
really the mean streets of the North Shore.
Yeah.
The hardscrabble is not the first phrase that jumps to mind when you hear the name Charlie Gifford, but I'll go with this.
Yeah.
So what were you into as a kid? What were you into, Christina?
Well, I will say I was a little bit dorky. So I didn't, I really like to read. But my true passion was swimming. So I joined a team when I was 5, and then was on the swim team through my senior year in high school when I tore my rotator cuff. But I loved being part of a team.
What was the high point of your high school swim career?
Okay. Well, I guess there was a couple. So I was on 2 teams. So I was on the Hamilton Wenham Generals in my freshman year. My relay won states. So that was very exciting. There's a terrible picture of me in the Boston Globe somewhere. Then when I was at Andover, one of my other relays, freestyle relay, actually set our school record. So those were probably my 2 highest points.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Christina, you mentioned earlier that you left Hamilton Wenham, which is a local high school, to go to Phillips Academy, AKA Andover, Phillips Andover, which is arguably one of the more demanding prep schools in the country. How was that transition, and how did you find how did you adjust to boarding school from living at home?
So that's a great question. I went to Andover when I was 15. So it was 10th grade. And it was a really hard transition, honestly. I'm very close to my family. I had sort of lifelong friends. You know, Hamilton's one of those places. There's like 120 kids in the like class. And so you get to know everyone and their families. And it's just a very tight-knit community. It was a hard transition, honestly. I think my freshman fall or my sophomore fall, it was tough. I was really homesick. But then actually swim season started in the winter, and, you know, being part of a team again and sort of finding my people and friends, I loved it. I would say it was incredibly challenging from an academic standpoint. And I think that was one of the reasons my parents wanted me to go, was they just felt like, you know, hey, you're not working very hard and you're getting good grades. Like, we want you to get like a C and to fail and to know what that feels like. So they'd sort of pushed me to go to Andover. And I'll say that, you know, the students there were, you know, some of the smartest people that I've ever met. It was pretty impressive. And they sort of came from all over. So they're, you know, I think my sophomore fall, you know, I looked around at other girls in my dorm, and it was, you know, someone from Saudi Arabia. There was, you know, somebody that had, you know, grown up in sort of an inner city situation from LA. So, I mean, it was a very diverse group of people, incredibly talented.
In hindsight, the right call.
I think so. Yeah.
And were your parents from the North Shore of Boston as well, or did they grow up around here?
No. So, it's an interesting story. So my father was born in Nanjing, in China, and my grandfather had won a contest when he was in college, and he was studying over in Caltech when World War II broke out. And so he actually went back to China first because the Japanese were invading China, and he moved the family out of Nanjing, which they later sacked, and then sort of moved them to a U.S. base in Germany. And then my father came over when he was about 7. And then my mother actually grew up in Hong Kong, and my grandmother had been born in Hawaii, and she was, I guess, maybe like had misbehaved a fair amount. And so they sent her back to Hong Kong so that she could learn like traditional Chinese ways. And her Chinese tutor was actually my grandfather. So my mother grew up in Hong Kong, and then they both actually ended up in New York City studying at various like graduate schools. And they met up, and I was actually born in Knoxville, Tennessee. So they moved there because my dad was working at Oak Ridge National Labs.
You described yourself when you were younger as kind of a nerdy kid, but it sounds like you were very adaptable and into a lot of stuff. But by the time you were at Andover, were you like in one group, or were you one of those kids who was friendly with everybody?
I definitely had a group of kids that I was very close to in Hamilton that I'm still friends with today. And then when I was in Andover, there's a group of girls. We would all just like live on the same floor. And so we spent a lot of time hanging out together, and then, you know, my swim team and others. So, you know, I feel like I would try to be friendly to everybody, but I definitely had a couple core groups of friends.
From Andover to Dartmouth, great experience.
I loved it. I mean, Dartmouth is one, it's just a very work hard, play hard environment. So I think if you're, if you like to go to a good party, I would say it's, you know, it's a great school, and I love the outdoors. So, you know, being able to go hiking or go snowboarding, it was a wonderful place. And I think they have this really fun program called like the D program. So you go to school during sophomore summer, and then you get a term off, like, you know, during your junior or sophomore year. And it was probably the most fun summer I've ever had. You know, it's just everybody from the sophomore class spends like their summer together in Hanover. You take a couple classes, and then just, you know, spend all this time with your friends. And it was a wonderful time for me, honestly.
At what point did your interest turn away from math, science, kind of your, you know, your family's areas of strength to business and finance?
Yeah. So, so my father was one of four, siblings. So the oldest son was an engineer. My aunt was a judge. Then there was my father, who was a scientist, and, his brother, who was into business. And it sort of thought about all of those different paths, and really where my interests lay were, you know, with business. And my parents had always said, you know, every summer you have to have a job to have spending money for the year. And so I, you know, it started out working at an ice cream store, and I worked at, you know, various businesses sort of like during my high school years, and, you know, got really interested in how to build businesses and how to grow. And so, you know, I took between that and taking some economics classes that I really liked at Andover, you know, it just seemed like a really good path. And then when I got to Dartmouth, they have all these sort of internship programs. So one year I was interning at a electricity trading company actually in Boston. And I thought, hey, this might be really interesting. But then I saw what they did all day, which was literally watch the Weather Channel, because electricity prices would spike when it got really hot and everyone would turn on their air conditioning. And I was like, that can't be my life. Like, it really just can't. Like, there's just, it was so awful. And then, you
know, the way I got interested in finance was when I was in college, there a professor had written, I was taking math, and he'd written a formula on the board. And it was kind of like a challenge that he left up to see if someone could solve the formula. And one morning people came in, and I had written out the formula on the board.
Were you also like a janitor, and was Robin Williams? I was. Like,
you totally saw through that. I need to come up with a better cover story.
Hey Andy, how do you like them apples?
I wasn't solving differential equations, but I did have an internship at JP Morgan as well, which I loved. And then I also had a management consulting internship, which I liked a little bit, but then I was kind of like, it seems really formulaic, and you can do a whole project and work on it all summer, and then your client's just like, I don't really want to do this. So I didn't love either of the, you know, trading path or the consulting path. I was really more interested in investment banking.
So from Hanover to New York City, a couple of years at JPM, and then you got into the principal investing game at FTG, right?
Yes. Yep. It was definitely interesting, because I think at JP Morgan, you're working with really large companies that probably don't need you at all. They just want your balance sheet. And, you know, I mean, it was cool. Like, you'd work with, you know, Kellogg, you'd work with Diageo, you know, you work with Kraft. But, you know, I mean, it was just sort of, it was very mechanical, I thought, and repetitive, and just the hours honestly were pretty killer. But FTG was really interesting, and I loved working with companies in sort of the size and, you know, stage of growth that they were working with. It was about a $300 million fund, and working with those management teams on, you know, add-on acquisitions and things like that were just very interesting.
So it was there that you really got the bug for principal investing?
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say that.
And then from, and then you transitioned away from FDG after a couple of years. You moved to the Mecca that is Bolton, Mass, and worked at Swift River, right? What's Swift River like?
Well, I was living in Boston, to be clear. But I, yeah, I did have to commute out to Bolton, Massachusetts every day. And it was really interesting. So our it was a family office of Tony James, who was at the time the president of the Blackstone Group, and his two brothers. And we had a, just a really broad mandate. So we could invest in venture capital deals, which we did. We could invest in buyouts, which we did. We bought a 40,000 acre cattle ranch because it was a good time to buy ranch land. You know, and it was just, to me, it was really intellectually interesting to be able to look at all these different asset classes and try to sort of find the best place to deploy capital.
Yeah. How do you feel when you look back at working at a fund versus working at a family office? You know, there are a lot of people I speak with that are considering going to join a family office. And I often say it can cut both ways. It could be the best job in the world, but it also, that the unintended consequence is you're at the whim of an immensely successful individual with, you know, real conviction in their beliefs, and they can change their mind and do whatever they want to do. And it may not be the same charter that you signed up for. You know, so if you had a friend that's saying, coming to you and asked, hey, should I move? You know, how do you think about working at a, you know, a dedicated blind pool capital fund versus, you know, a large family office?
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's a great question. I think the breadth of the types of opportunities you can look at a family office is really, really interesting. I think you can be very differentiated capital. So to go to a family and founder and say, you know, hey, we have a longer term view than a more institutional private equity fund, I think that's differentiating. I think it's a good lifestyle. I think that, you know, if you work in a more institutional fund, there's a lot more pressure to deploy and sort of return capital to investors. And for me, I find that more fulfilling just because I feel like, you know, you're right. Like you could be like some, a family could say, hey, you know, this year we're not deploying capital. And while it's great and, you know, you can go travel and do all kinds of things, it's, you know, from a professional standpoint, not nearly as fulfilling. I think there's something really good, at least for me personally, for having like a clock, if that makes sense.
The most surprising development to me in our industry in the last 10 years, I think, is that family offices have not been able to establish a larger foothold as a result of not being constrained by institutional investor holding period expectations. And then the other side of that, that private equity firms have not been under more pressure to move away from the traditional kind of 10-year life fund construct in order to compete with them.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's harder for, well, I think family offices are a lot less aggressive. And I think, you know, they can be a bit more value oriented. So, you know, in the sort of time period through 2020, mid-2022, I think it was harder for them to compete, to be honest. And I think they're not always viewed as the best buyer by investment bankers.
Well, I think it, I think it's the cultural difference that you're alluding to. I mean, in a lot of circumstances, being able to say, we can hold this asset as long as we want to and as long as management feels we should, without any regard for what our investors are looking for. It's such a powerful statement to be able to make. And because of just the difference in general, the difference in the family office DNA versus the private equity fund investment company DNA, it hasn't had that big of an impact in the market.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do also think that management teams see the power of the sort of second bite of the apple, if you will. And I think there are a lot of management teams that gravitate towards, you know, hey, I want to get the company to this stage. Then I want to work with Fort Point and, you know, double, triple the size of our company. I want to go to market again. I want to then go, you know, sell to Charlie's firm. So, you know, I think there are a lot of management teams that actually like the sort of pressure of the time clock and the certainty of knowing that when it all economically makes sense for equity holders, a firm will exit.
I think one reason, not the only reason, is private equity funds and their investors have been opportunistic in using continuation vehicles and other ways of enabling you guys to extend the holding period where it makes sense to do so. And so that theoretical advantage has been minimized.
It's definitely possible.
Yeah. So speaking of Fort Point, tell us, you know, you were there at the creation. Tell us about that and tell us the Fort Point story.
Sure. Well, happy to. So I was at Swift River for about half a dozen years, and it got to the point where the family was no longer wanted to deploy capital through the vehicle. And so, you know, they were just working on portfolio optimization. And I was talking to somebody that I was working with on a nonprofit fundraising committee. And he said, hey, you know, a friend of mine that I went to college with is raising a fund. And I was looking around and, you know, had various options at, you know, established private equity firms or even, you know, corporations in the Boston area. But I guess I was at a point in my career where I thought it would be interesting to take a risk and do something entrepreneurial. You know, I didn't really have an original idea to start a business or anything, but I wanted to be part of building something. And so I decided to join Fort Point before we had a fund. They'd done one deal as a fundless sponsor. So I joined Brooke Ablon and Paul Lipson. So they were partners who had spun out of Fidelity. And we decided to start Fort Point. And, you know, everyone's like, well, where did you get the name? Because every single private equity name is always taken, you know, River and Stone and everything else. But we were looking out. We had free office space from a law firm. We were looking out the window and there's the Fort Point neighborhood.
There it was.
And, you know, we spent a lot of time, I guess, in the early days talking about what we were really passionate about and where we wanted to focus our investment strategy and what types of businesses we wanted to work with. You know, and I think the three of us really love growing businesses. I mean, that's what really sort of drives our passion from a career perspective. And so working with family and founder-owned businesses where we felt like there was the most potential for outsized growth was really where we triangulated. And then from an industry perspective, we'd spent collectively the most time in the business services sector. So that's where we decided to focus. And then subsequently raised a few funds. We're currently investing out of our third fund.
You're listening to Middle Market Musings, brought to you by New Heritage Capital and Greenberg Variations Capital. Before we get into kind of where you are today, myself and my two partners, when we spun out of our predecessor firm in 2006, we did deals on a deal-by-deal basis, completed four, you know, pretty good-sized transactions that all worked out wonderfully. At the time, we thought we were going to just continue on in this kind of concept, doing deals on a deal-by-deal basis. And this, again, is a long time ago, long before the proliferation that we see today. But we found ourselves at a competitive disadvantage of trying to gain the confidence of the seller or the seller's agent to get exclusivity to do our work and then eventually close the deal. Was that always the plan with you all when you did one deal on a deal-by-deal basis, then you raised your blind pool? Was that always the intent to raise that blind pool as fast as possible? Or did you ever all think about doing it on a deal-by-deal basis? Because as we all know, if you do it that way and it works out well, it works out really, really well.
Yeah. No, I mean, definitely deal-by-deal carry is always a great thing. But, you know, we always had the intention of raising a fund. I think we wanted, you know, we wanted to build the team. We wanted to have the certainty. And like you said, Charlie, I mean, I think it was really hard to convince people like we, you know, we definitely have capital. We definitely can close. I think sometimes there's some misalignment to, not saying for you guys, but for, you know, fundless sponsors to feel some sort of pressure to do deals that they don't maybe necessarily love. But they really just want to deploy capital. And we wanted to get away from that and have a pool of committed capital. I would say we've definitely made some mistakes in the beginning. So we didn't hire a placement agent originally. We decided to raise capital on our own. And we took a lot of meetings with a lot of people who really had no interest in investing in first-time funds. Or they'd say, well, you know, we'll write a $100 million check, but we'd only want to be 10% of a fund. And we're like, okay, well, you know, we're raising $100 million. So
funny. We had the first one. We just raised fund four. We called portfolio one as the collection of deals we did on a deal by deal basis. In fund two, we did it by ourselves. And I remember, like, you know, having lots of great meetings, and then you tell somebody that, oh yeah, we just met with investor LP ABC, and they're like, they have no money and they haven't had money in 2 years, but you don't know it.
No idea.
I'll take any meeting to try to raise capital. And it's always a kind of real OTJ on the job training if you don't have that placement agent. So you guys did hire a placement agent for fund two?
Yep. For fund two and fund three. Yeah. We've used Forum, and they're great. It's so helpful in terms of streamlining the process. And I also think the process has gotten a lot more efficient. Well, A, if you have LPs, but B, like, you can raise an entire fund over Zoom.
What is a teaser? I mean, you could either answer this question with a hypothetical or with one of the deals that you've done. A teaser that crosses your desk where you have said, this is the perfect Fort Point Capital deal. This deal, this situation is in our wheelhouse. What does that look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, we like to find sort of niches that are like a little bit off center. So, I'll tell you about the most recent platform that we closed. It's a company called Ice House America. And, you know, honestly, I've never really thought about ice in my whole life. I mean, I don't even really drink a lot of ice.
I have thought about ice. Because years ago, I was working on some deal, and it was water-related, and somebody told me that the most disgusting water you come in contact with is the water in ice in a hotel ice machine.
It's
because they never clean them.
It's disgusting, anything on an airplane. But
how uplifting.
I will tell you though that our company's ice is very fresh and very pure and has never been touched by anybody and is always clean.
Right. But that's the Charlie's never, you've never thought about ice, Charlie?
No.
It's kind of,
I guess I need to be a deeper thinker.
So we try to find these sort of niches that, you know, you don't think about all the time. You know, we're not really interested in buying like a landscaping company or anything like that, but or a car wash. Although I was told you aren't a private equity firm unless you own a car wash. So
we should let you take a clean swing at the ice business.
Okay. So the company was started. So if you think about the traditional ice industry, it's basically like a Ready Ice or Home City, Arctic Glacier. Ice is produced in a centralized manufacturing plant. A lot of people touch it. There's a fleet that just sort of distributes the ice to various, you know, C stores and grocery stores, commercial accounts, et cetera. You know, can't flex up and down in capacity, lots of labor costs, fuel costs, et cetera. And so the founders said, well, what if we could make ice in place, you know, fresh, clean ice that nobody touches. So they started making these ice houses. And they're basically the size of two parking lots. They're hooked up to municipal power and water. And then they can vend ice, and it's UV treated, it's filtered, it's reverse osmosis, and it's produced on demand. And so one of the ice houses can produce 13,000 pounds of ice a day. And as you can imagine, you can sell it for a very significant discount to traditional ice. So that was sort of the genesis of the company. And then off of that, the management team had built a number of revenue streams. So sort of a software monitoring solution, which is sold to monitor their fleet, but also third-party ice and water vending. They had an aftermarket parts and service business, and then they were selling the machines to both owner-operators as well as commercial accounts and retail. And they were doing a roll-up. So there are 4,500 ice houses that are distributed all over the U.S., and many of them are owned by owner-operators, and they were going in and sort of buying them all back. And so we thought, you know, this is a really wonderful company that we could look at. It's like, it's in a niche. It's disrupting the whole industry. Like, so vended ice is now 10% of the market, and it's projected to grow pretty significantly and take share because the old model is just not great. And then we thought there was a really big opportunity on the sort of acquisition side. So there's, you know, 4,500 units. The company owned 160. So we could go in and sort of roll that up and then sort of build out the software offering. And there's, we thought there was a pricing opportunity as well. So we liked it because we thought this company really has the opportunity to grow very significantly. And like, if one of those strategies doesn't really work, you know, there's so many other ways to create value. And that's what made it interesting to us. You asked about a teaser stage, but we also love the management team. So we thought they were, you know, strategic, operational, really hardworking, great partners.
So Christina, was this part of a process?
It was. Yeah.
Why do you think they chose you and your partners?
Well, they said that the management team loved us the best. And I thought that that was true. And then I had a call last week with the investment banker, and he's like, I just want to let you guys know, you definitely didn't overpay. And at that point, I had thought we didn't overpay, but then I definitely did think we did. So I think we
why you know why, Chris?
Speaking as a banker, why would a banker say that?
Present company included, sometimes tells
the investment banker, honestly, he's a wonderful human being. And I think he's a really nice guy. And I think he just wanted to be like, just so you know, you didn't overpay. And that made me think we 100% had. But, you know, so I think it was probably a combination. We had the management team liked us a lot. They talked to a number of our CEOs. They liked what they thought we would do with the business. I think we really understood what an important transaction it was to them. And, you know, we also probably paid the highest price, would be my guess.
Interesting. And you're currently investing out of Fund 3, which was, how big is that fund?
$350 million.
Uh-huh. And then the increases from Fund 1, Fund 2, Fund 3, they've been kind of a step function? Or are they, how are you thinking about future growth? And I assume you're writing larger checks, or are you doing more deals in the fund, or how are you all structuring it?
Yeah. So our first fund was $100 million. Our second fund was $200 million. The third fund is $350 million. You know, it is a struggle. I mean, we love businesses that have like $3 million of EBITDA or $4 million of EBITDA, $5 million of EBITDA. And I think for fund one and fund two, it was easy to fit those in the portfolio. And I'm hopeful that in fund three, we still will and just do more deals. And that's sort of been our strategy. I think you'll find us going a little bit up market. So where there's, you know, 10, 11, 12 million of EBITDA, I think we'll start to be more competitive. I hope we never leave our heritage of, you know, working with the sort of true lower middle market companies.
But isn't that such a different competitive universe?
It is.
Going out, you know, right? Going after the larger deals.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple things. So, you know, Ice House is a great example. It was a larger deal for us, but, you know, they'd gotten the company to a place where there's so many different ways to drive value immediately. I mean, we've bought probably 40 Ice Houses in the last 2 months. I mean, it's, you know, it's just a really interesting platform and with a number of different ways to create value. They've built out their management team. They've built out the technology and we can just really accelerate their growth. I think when you, and so you kind of can pay a premium multiple for that, knowing that you can average down with add-on acquisitions and all the work that you're going to do. I think with some of the smaller companies, you can get them for a more attractive multiple, but they're riskier. And there's definitely a lot more work that goes into really driving value over your whole period. So I think a healthy balance of the two makes sense.
Do you envision a professional life for yourself beyond private equity? I mean, obviously you're in the thick of it now, but is there some fantasy job in your future?
That's something I spend a lot of time thinking about. And it was really interesting. One of my portfolio companies had this sort of training seminar this week about personas over 50 and sort of all these different, you know, buckets that people fall into. And one of them was like balanced breezers, where people feel like they've worked so hard and they just want to enjoy life, which sounded really, really excellent, but I just don't think I'll ever do it. You know, I always want to be doing something. So whether it's serving on boards or working more with nonprofit organizations, I'd love to do something. At some point, maybe just buy a company for myself and, you know, run it and see how it goes. But so I don't, you know, I haven't fully decided on that path. I mean, I honestly, I love what I do and I hope to be doing it for a lot longer. But then afterwards, I just don't think I'll ever not work.
Mm-hmm.
Christina, share with us a bit about the culture at Four Point.
Yeah, you know, we're very team oriented, honestly. You know, we were, I think it was during COVID, we went back in July of 2020, back into the office. You know, and we spent a lot of time, you know, working together in deal teams, but as a team overall. And it's a fun place to work. I mean, it's, I'd say it's, we don't have a lot of FaceTime and we're pretty flexible in terms of, you know, if you have to go home because of a family emergency or something, it's, you know, always understood. But, you know, I think, you know, we work hard and we have fun hanging out together. So it's a good place to work.
As you think about, this is related to the comment that you were making about larger deals versus smaller deals. Smaller deals, of course, are more likely to be proprietary. How do you think about continuing to look at opportunities where it's lightly competitive and you have a, you know, you have a more well-developed angle as opposed to larger business, broader auction?
I mean, honestly, we'd love smaller situations where we have an angle and we definitely try to create those. You know, we have a lot of active buy-side searches around theme research that we do. You know, we try to create good relationships with folks so they know that, you know, they can trust how we'll act in a process, and include us in some of those smaller beauty contests. So we would prefer it, but I mean, I think we'll all be honest. I mean, most of the deal flow comes through broad auctions. And if you want to see, you know, all of the best possible, investment opportunities, I think you have to pursue both.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you know, Greenberg Variations Capital, as Charlie never tires of hearing, is based on the, you know, the focused process. The business owners made the determination that they're going to sell to, you know, one buyer or a small group of buyers. I think that even among the largest middle market funds, more targeted processes is going to continue to occupy a larger share of the business.
Well, it's definitely been a trend in the past year. I think that just given the difficulties in the M&A market, you know, a lot of sellers have said to themselves, like, well, why don't we test the market? Then we don't have to tell everyone that we went out to market and let's just see if there's interest. So I think that's been the genesis of a lot of the recent sort of smaller processes. And I do think like a lot of firms, ourselves included, has probably narrowed in a little bit more on sort of what we truly are interested mm-hmm. in instead of, you know, taking a million meetings or a million teasers, you know, really trying to sort of carve out, this is, you know, these are the types of companies we like, these are what we're focused on. So I do think that processes are narrowing a bit, but I think that hopefully when the M&A market comes back from a volume perspective, my guess is that auctions will return.
Do you think so?
I do.
I feel like particularly for the 5 million EBITDA business as opposed to the 10 million plus business, there will, if it's a desirable business, desirable sector, there will continue to be a premium from the sponsor standpoint on becoming known to as many intermediaries as possible. When they're assembling a list on behalf of a client and they're saying, look, we're not going to boil the ocean, as they say. We're going to find the right 30 or 40 firms. You're on as many of those lists as possible.
Oh, I definitely think that. But I do think, you know, from our standpoint, if we're selling a company, I mean, oftentimes people will say, well, these are, you know, our tier one buyers. But I mean, from some of the processes we've run, you know, the buyer, ultimate buyer is like a tier two or a tier three buyer. And so if you're, you know, a private equity or institutional seller, it's like right. You want to get sort of top dollar. And so you're going to go out to everyone who's possibly interested because you never know.
Right. Well, I'm talking about the individual and family owned seller, not the institutional seller.
Sure. Yeah, they may want to be part of a smaller process. I mean, that's definitely possible.
Christina, let's return to where we began. Our shared love of Boston sports. Do you listen to any podcasts about Boston sports, or do you listen to any podcasts at all? Obviously, other than Middle Market Musings.
Middle Market Musings is my number one podcast, but
yeah. You seem like a woman of great judgment, so that's, I get that.
Secondarily, I love the Bill Simmons podcast. I listen to Ryan Russillo.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Those are two great ones. I love those guys.
They're really awesome.
Simmons had Edelman on recently. I think it dropped over the last couple of days. You should listen to that. That's a pretty good one.
Yeah, I definitely will. I was listening to one. He was talking about, I think, the worst 20 contracts in the NBA.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. I have a question for the two of you. If you could go in a, you know, time travel to any Boston sporting event prior to the Red Sox winning the World Series in 2004, which one would you want to go to?
I think you should try that again and say the Patriots winning in 2001, because that was the beginning of the run of championships. Okay. So before January or February of 2002, when the Patriots won, what was the question? What sporting event would you want to be at?
Well, that they're winning in February of 2002 qualified under my question.
Well, I know, but I just think the logical question to ask is, I mean, that's relevant.
Before
my point is like before the golden age of Boston sports.
I now see your arguably correct, but undermining point, which is that I picked the wrong starting benchmark.
Yes, you did. Yeah,
all right.
You did.
So, 2 decades of dominance.
Christina's the last man standing here. Christina, you can go any event prior to February of 2002.
I would want to see the 86 Celtics win the title. You also? Or you did see it?
I was there in 86, which is, I think, the best team in the history of basketball. And I know Andy agrees with me. I'd say the Bobby Orr game when they beat the Blues in 1971, and that famous picture of him flying through the air, that would have been quite a game.
I mean, honestly, prior to the golden age of Boston sports, I think there weren't really so many times you might want to see the Red Sox or the Patriots. So it was really, it would have to be a Celtics or Bruins.
Fun fact, in 1978, the Bucky effing Dent game, remember that, you know, that famous game when the Red Sox had like a 10 game lead. I was a Ute and I was all of 9 years old, and my dad had 3 tickets. So we invited my maternal grandfather, my paternal grandfather, and me. And I walked in as his child at 9 years old. I was probably 5'10" at the time, and I sat in his lap with my dad and my two grandfathers, only to watch Mike Torres give up a meatball to Bucky effing Dent, and then that wasn't fun. But Andy doesn't even know what I'm talking about.
It's like ground ball through the leg.
I would want to see Ted Williams hit.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously did not result in any World Series titles. Ted Williams, Tony Gwynn, arguably the two greatest hitters of a baseball the past 100 years.
Tony Gwynn. That's okay.
That's an interesting one. I mean, I might say like I liked watching Manny Ramirez swing
about. Watching Manny Ramirez was great to watch, and I remember being at Fenway Park once. Not I obviously don't get there as often as the two of you. When he was playing, and because he was so compact, the sound of him making solid contact was like gunfire.
There was a guy I knew from Cleveland who was in like single A ball. And when he was like 19, he was pitching to a 21-year-old Manny Ramirez. And he said that he hit a home run off him in like a Grapefruit League game. And he said, the ball almost hit him in the head, but then it kept rising as it went over the center field wall. He said, I've never seen anything get hit so hard, and it almost killed me. And you'd think that it was going to hit the pitcher in the head. It wouldn't have been a home run, but the thing was just like a heat-seeking missile as it disappeared over the center field fence.
Yeah, I mean, his fielding wasn't great, but he just had this swing.
Yeah.
I loved watching him hit.
He was an odd, man. Okay, well, Christina, listen, you've been immensely generous with your time. Really have enjoyed getting to know you, and we're immensely grateful for you sharing your story. And we wish you and Paul and Brooke and the rest of the team at Four Point nothing but continued success. So thank you so much.
Hear, hear.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It was great to spend the last 45 minutes with you. And hopefully we can spend some time together in person soon.
Very much look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Middle Market Musings. We'd like to once again thank Christina Pye for joining us today, and also thank our sponsors, New Heritage Capital and Greenberg Variations Capital. Thanks as well to our editor, Jason Zappolo. If you enjoyed today's podcast, we'd encourage you to like and follow Middle Market Musings on Spotify, Apple, or whichever provider you use to access podcasts. And of course, feel free to share with your friends. Thanks again, and look forward to catching you on the next one.